Hello and welcome to Inside Education. You can visit our website for podcasts of all our programmes. The address is insideed.com. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on today's programme.
It did seem that kind of a varied use of computers for learning but also for socialising and for relaxing, that can contribute to children's learning, and that is something that could definitely be kind of tapped into.
I'll be talking to Emer Smith of the Economic and Social Research Institute about two recent studies on education published by the Institute. And Barry Hennessy has been looking at the levels of physical activity among students in Irish schools. But first, this week, we look at ICT in third level institutions. A couple of weeks ago on the programme, I spoke to Steve Wheeler about blogging and about how technology is changing education as we know it. Steve Wheeler is a psychologist and an associate professor of learning technology at Plymouth University. He was the keynote speaker at the recent conference of the Computer Education Society of Ireland, and I spoke to him outdoors at the conference. In fact, if you listen carefully, you'll hear the crows cawing in the background. Although Steve Wheeler is an advocate of technology in education, he doesn't like virtual learning environments. He'll explain why in just a moment. But first I asked him if any of the courses he teaches in Plymouth University are delivered online.
We have had some of my master's courses delivered entirely online. But having said that, I always insist on having face-to-face meetings at the start and at the end with students. I call it the bookend model because at the start you want to establish the boundaries. You want to create a relationship with your students, and you can't always do that online because of the reduced social cues. But what you can do with a face-to-face meeting is establish what the expectations are. You can gauge the audience. You can find out what your students want and expect from you. And at the end, I always have a meeting with them to consolidate. In the middle, then anything can happen. So it's online, you have video conferences, you maybe have students creating content and sharing it on blogs or whatever. Lots of problem-based learning as well we use. In the middle, anything can happen, but the bookend model, I think, actually works. And I've used that for several years in my master's programme.
And how do you compare the learning on the master's programme with, say, the online model with the bookends versus the entire face-to-face model?
It's different because, firstly, students are no longer constrained by geography. They can be anywhere in the world learning. Obviously, we try to get them together for the first and last meeting, the bookend meetings. But generally speaking, even if they can't do that, then there is the ability to engage with the resources, the content, the learner group, and also the tutors using technology. So that's important to remember. But having said that, sometimes some students are not very happy with it. It doesn't suit every student, put it that way.
In terms of your own preparation, how does the preparation for online work compare or contrast with the preparation for face-to-face work?
It's not easy. it's very difficult because you have to think of a lot more of the parameters than you would if you were face to face, because of the reduced social queuing, because of the idea that that students may want to ask a question but don't know how to ask it, but they would in a class by putting their hand up or by just speaking. How do they get to you when you're 1,000 miles away from them? That's one of the issues. So you have to think of the logistics. You have to think of the psychological and physical separation. It has to be built in there somehow. We have to create more around the content, things like cues, hints, ideas of how they can elaborate on their searching, how they can home in on new details which they'd miss because the tutor isn't there to indicate to them where they look next. So the nuances are different when you're teaching online. So there's more preparation, and I have to say also there's also more engagement at the assessment and feedback level and at the tutorial support level, because constantly students are emailing you and you're having to answer emails. You wouldn't generally be doing that normally in a face-to-face meeting.
And that's more hidden work in terms of your bosses and things like that?
Oh yeah, they don't see that. A manager expects you to create a distance education course because they think it's going to make them more money, but actually it loses them money. What it does gain in is the quality, because quality in education can be improved, I think, through the use of particular technologies in the right context.
And how then do you evaluate the quality of an online course?
Well, we used to evaluate it using three parameters, quality, access and cost. But I think that, again, is the wrong way to evaluate content, evaluate content delivery through distance education. Now, the best way to actually evaluate it now is not even in through increased grades, because grades themselves, you know, the marking process, I think, is artificial. We're not always assessing what we want to assess. I think the best way to possibly ascertain whether a course is successful or not is whether students want to come back for more.
You're not a fan of virtual learning environments. Why not?
Well, I mean, there are several reasons why I think that the current virtual learning environment system is wrong. Firstly, it's been imposed upon schools and colleges and universities by outside forces. Secondly, the businesses who run these and develop and design these tools, they listen to you to a certain extent, but then they go off and do what they want to do and design them the way they think they should be delivered. That's the second problem. The third problem is that they homogenize content. Students are all different, but they expect you to learn in a particular way in a VLE. And fourthly, and probably one of the most important reasons why I don't like them, is because they ring-fence students in, and often they lock you down into a particular, not just a particular way of thinking, but also a particular zone of operation, so that it's difficult for you to connect with students outside the group or outside the university or even outside the country if you want to. And increasingly, learning is taking place globally. We are connecting with people around the world to learn. That kind of connectivist idea that Stephen Downes and George Siemens promote, that's not going to happen in a controlled walled garden of a VLE. One fifth view on this is it's expensive. You know, it's not just expensive, it's draining the lifeblood out of certain institutions, because they have to spend so much on it each year to keep that subscription going.
But if you take the opposite view and you make your course material available worldwide, then doesn't that have implications for the funding of universities in future?
Apparently not, because many universities, in fact, now, and I'm talking the big ones like Harvard and the Open University and Cambridge and, you know, MIT and so on, they're opening up their content for free, a lot of it. The model is that you give your content away for free now, and then you charge for the accreditation, because learning is learning is learning. You can learn as much as you like. That's part of the deal, but to actually become accredited, then you have to pay for it. And I think that's a new type of model that's going to be increasingly seen around the world.
Finally, Steve, your talk today is titled Enhanced Learning Futures. What is your key message for Irish teachers at the talk today?
Well, the cue is in the last word, really, futures plural. There are lots of possible futures for digital learning, lots of possible futures which we can and probably will see. So, for instance, open views, which I've just mentioned, the open scholarship view of learning, that is one of our futures that we have to grasp. The more you give away, the more you get back. I've always said that knowledge is like love. You can give it away as much as you like, but you still get to keep it. And it's so true. I give away a lot of my content. And in fact, all my content I give away. I'm not going to close any of it down. I've given up editing or reviewing or writing for closed journals because I think it's inequitable. I resigned last year as editor of a major high-profile journal, Taylor & Francis Journal, for that very reason, because I think it's wrong to close content down and charge for it, especially when public funding has probably paid for it in the first place. So what I do is I give all my content away for free. I post my slides up. I presented a slideshow 3 weeks ago in London. Currently, if you look at it on SlideShare, it's approaching 40,000 views. But that, to me, is amazing in itself. But when you open it up on Creative Commons licensing for repurposing as well, that means that people can do what they want with it. And many people have taken my slideshows and my blog posts and my videos and so on, and they've translated them into other languages. So one of my blog posts recently was translated into Spanish. Now, that didn't only open up a new audience in Spain, it opened up the whole of South America for me. That for me also is gold dust, because I want my ideas to be discussed. You know, I don't want them to be closed down behind a firewall, you know, behind a paywall. I want them to be discussed openly. So for me, openness is one of the futures. There are others as well. I'm talking now, for instance, about the difference between touch and non-touch technologies. That's going to be another future that we have to decide on. And I think in many years' time, our grandchildren will sit on our knees and say, "Granddad, did you really have to touch your computer to make it work?" You know, all of these futures, I think, are open to us.
And that was Steve Wheeler from Plymouth University, who delivered the keynote address at the recent SESI conference. Next in the programme, we go to Barry Hennessy, who this week has been looking at physical education. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. Irish teenage girls between the ages of 15 and 18 spend up to 19 hours a day either sitting or lying down, a behaviour pattern that's particularly marked during the school day. That's according to researchers at the University of Limerick, who say that more school-based interventions are needed to stave off the negative health effects of leading a sedentary lifestyle. Alan Donnelly is Professor of Exercise Physiology at the University of Limerick, and he's been telling me about the research.
About really is trying to quantify what we call sedentary behaviour. So that's the patterns of sitting and lying during the course of the day. And to do that, we're particularly interested in adolescent females who we believe may be more inactive than their male peers. Now, we had a randomly selected population from 12 schools across County Limerick and Limerick City. And we ended up with 111 volunteers in our study. And essentially, all they do is we put on a very small and inconspicuous accelerometer that sticks to their leg, and they wear that more or less continuously for 7 days. And the key finding of this study on sedentary behaviour is that, in fact, there are differences between weekdays and weekends in their sedentary patterns. And the background to this is that sitting for long periods may have a separate health consequence to lack of exercise. What we found is that they are most inactive in weekdays between 9 and 3, essentially during school time.
Do we know how Ireland or how Irish teenage girls compare with their peers elsewhere in the developed world?
On that from DCU, and we have our own evidence. And if you compare where we stand, unfortunately, Ireland probably has a very similar behavioural pattern to the US and perhaps to the UK, in that we would probably be worse than our European peers in terms of physical activity across both males and females. So what we're finding, I think, is that in recent years there is most likely to have been a decline in physical activity levels in the population we're studying.
What kind of school-based interventions do you think would be useful? Because I know that one of the things that you point out in the research is that school-based interventions are lacking here. Aside from the timetabled PE periods, what can schools do?
Well, I think, you know, it's twofold, really. I think there's a physical activity side, which is very important, and you know, there are things in, say, moving around the school that you can encourage children to be active, children and adolescents. And active commuting is one of the key things that schools can engage with, because there are many studies that show that active commuting can, you know, be a good source of physical activity. And that's something that has dropped. You know, we all see the queues of cars outside school gates. And I think that, you know, just getting people to walk, or children and adolescents to walk or cycle to school, can make a difference. The one key issue that may have an effect is that every 40 minutes a bell rings and either the teacher moves or the pupils move. And there has been a trend in more recent years to going to teacher moves simply because it's much easier to manage. But, you know, principals perhaps should think that there is value in the small amount of physical activity that children and adolescents get just in the few minutes in between classes moving around, because it's breaking sedentary periods, and that is actually very important.
What about the distinction that we might draw here between physical activity and physical education? Wouldn't we be better off focusing on educating them regarding being more active and the importance of that, as opposed to trying to bring more of that into the classroom?
To go for an approach that has many facets, and it's not just one thing. And I do think that physical education has a role. Now, the role in terms of physical activity isn't so much the physical activity they do in PE classes, because most schools have only one or two PE lessons per week, and the contribution of that to an adolescent's weekly physical activity may actually be quite small. But I think where physical education can play a role is in educating the adolescents about behaviour and introducing them in, draconian. You know, you don't have to make them do, you know, circuits before they come in the door in the morning. I think it is a case of finding things that will work. And very simple things can make a difference. I mean, there have been experiments in the UK with preventing parking within 200 metres of schools, which simply means that the pupils have to walk those 200 metres back, you know, each day. And small things like that accumulated can make a difference. Lots of small changes can make a difference.
Professor Alan Donnelly. Alan is Professor of Exercise Physiology at the University of Limerick.
And that report came to us from Barry Hennessy, and Barry will of course be back with another report on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. The programme's website is insideed.com. Next on today's programme, we find out more about two education-related studies recently published by the Economic and Social Research Institute, the ERSI. In order to find out more about the studies, I met up with Dr. Emer Smith. Emer Smith is a research professor at the ESRI. Her areas of interest include education, school-to-work transitions, comparative methodology and gender issues. Emer is on the management team of the Growing Up in Ireland study. She is co-editor of the journal Irish Educational Studies. One of the studies I discussed with Emer is about the influences on nine-year-olds' learning, home, school and community. But first, she told me about a study on the primary classroom, insights from the Growing Up in Ireland study. I first asked Emer to tell me what kind of questions the teachers were asked.
The teachers were asked quite a range of questions. They were asked a set of questions about the pupils specifically, but they were also asked about their own experiences as teachers, the kind of teaching methods they used, their perception of facilities and resources, and even their own satisfaction with the job and their own stress levels. And as well as that, we collected information from the school principal about actual resources in the school, kind of perception of the needs and abilities of the students themselves. So we had quite a rich source of information on the context within which students were learning.
One of the ideas that you were particularly interested in was the area of active learning. And what questions did you ask the teachers to try and determine the extent to which they were practicing active learning, or they were encouraging active learning in the classrooms?
Well, we were very interested in looking at teaching methods, because the primary curriculum from 1999 had actually kind of set out a very child-centred approach which favoured active learning, but there's been very little information on whether that's actually happening in the classrooms. So teachers would have been asked about the frequency of a range of different kinds of things, like how often they, you know, encourage children to use hands-on activities, how often they use group work, pair work, then how often they would use kind of more teacher-centred, you know, reading from kind of the board, reading from textbooks and so on.
And of course, you didn't just ask the teachers those questions. You also tried to find out from the children what their experience was. What did you ask them?
We asked them really about their views of school, the extent to which they liked their teacher, liked school, looked forward to going to school. And then we asked about subject areas, focusing on English, Irish and maths.
And what then did you find out in terms of active learning and its relationship to the children's learning?
Well, we didn't look at the impact on the children's learning at this stage, because we want to wait until we have the follow-up data to look at the impact of experience at 9 years of age on the kind of outcomes at 13. What we really wanted to kind of look at was, well, which groups of children are getting exposure to these kind of active methods? And there are variations by group. So it tends to be more that girls are in classrooms where they're more exposed to active teaching and learning, also children in Gaeilge Scoileanna and children in non-disadvantaged schools. And the kind of teacher also makes a difference. So it's younger teachers tend to be the ones who are using the more active methodologies. So it's those who have experienced their kind of their teacher education and training more recently, whereas the older teachers would tend to use more teacher-centred approaches.
So we can't really match how effective the approaches are to the children's achievement. It's more whether or not they're having these experiences.
Yes, at this stage we're looking at that, because we want to look then at the longer term outcomes. And we're actually in the field with the 13-year-olds at the moment, so the time does go by very quickly. But we know from other research we've done and from research internationally that children and young people tend to favour those more active learning approaches, that they tend to find them more engaging than the sort of more structured teacher-centred class.
And would you have any concerns that, say, you know, if a teacher says that, yeah, I'm practicing active learning, but in some cases it might not be that effective. In other words, children might be spending time off tasks, say if they're working in groups, or they might be, you know, not interacting. They might be working individually, even though they're working in a group. To what extent are you concerned about that in your study?
Well, obviously we couldn't tap into that in the level of detail that you would really need. I think you would really need something like a classroom or observation study really to be able to tap into those issues. And there are issues about time off task, but there are also important issues about the use of differentiation where it is a more teacher-centred lesson. So, you know, is the teacher addressing the needs of all the students in the class, or are some students falling behind and so on?
Because you found some contradictions there, in that you found that in some DESH schools, teachers were more likely to be differentiating, but at the same time, children in general were experiencing less active learning methods in DESH schools.
And we can't be wholly sure, but we think it's because of the use of more structured literacy and numeracy programmes in DESH schools that they kind of require that there would be a more focused and more structured kind of approach in certain classes.
You also found some evidence that boys were becoming disengaged in school, even at the age of 9. I mean, obviously that's worrying. Do you have any background to that, or any ideas as to why that might be the case?
We're not entirely sure. We were concerned. Obviously, we've done work before in second level education where you see stark gender differences at that stage, but we wouldn't really have expected that that would date back so far into the primary system. Now, I mean, the thing to remember is that most of children, both boys and girls, are engaged in learning and are positive about their school experiences. But gender is emerging, and it's emerging over and above other factors like social background and so on. So we're not really sure what the root of it is, but there also is a difference, in especially in literacy subjects like English and Irish, that the boys are being more negative, whereas there are no gender differences there in perceptions of maths. So possibly something to do with kind of literacy, and they're less likely to read for pleasure outside school as well.
And can I ask you just a technical research question on that? You say that this observation about boys emerges even taking into account things like social class and so on, and so that's often referred to as controlling for social class. How exactly do you do that?
It's about trying to compare like with like. So you're saying, you know, what are the experiences of a boy from a particular social background and of a particular age living in a particular location compared to a girl in a broadly similar situation? So it's the way statistically controlling or taking account of those other factors that might be driving the outcome you're looking at.
One other striking observation in that study was that there was huge variation in terms of the amount of time that teachers spend teaching different subjects. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we were actually quite struck by that, because we actually found, say, in a subject like maths, you could get as much of a gap as 2 hours a week in the time spent in maths. If you total that up over the school year, that's about 18 days of instruction. So we would be concerned that in the longer term, that could mean that some students aren't really kind of embracing some of the knowledge domains in the way that they might. And the variation wasn't just random. I mean, there were differences in the amount of time spent on particular subjects by student gender. So, for example, boys tended to get to spend more time on PE, whereas girls got to spend more time on religious education. And there was also differences by the teacher experience. So the kind of more experienced teachers tended to focus more on a sort of core curriculum of English, Irish and maths, and spend a little bit less time on maybe some of the arts subjects like drama.
Was there any evidence, or did you look at this, at the extent to which a principal could influence that in a school?
We couldn't see that directly, but we saw differences between schools, but most of the differences were between teachers in the same school. So while the school might be driving some of it, a lot of it was down to what the individual teacher was doing in her or his own classroom.
Now, the second study I spoke to Emer Smith about is a study entitled Influences on 9-Year-Olds' Learning, Home, School and Community. This study looked at how children's after-school activities affect their learning. The study categorised children into 5 groups based on how they spend their time outside school. First of all, I asked Emer Smith to describe briefly the five groups for me.
The least structured group were really those who spent a lot of time watching television and hanging out with their friends and not doing very much reading for pleasure or much cultural activity. So they were one group, and they actually turned out to have the lowest reading and math scores. Then we had a group that we called our social networkers, who were a group of predominantly girls who were using computers in a very varied way outside school, and they were combining that with reading and with cultural activities. We had a group then of the cultural activities who were engaged in music, dance, drama lessons, and spent a lot of time reading for pleasure. Then we had a group that were much more focused on sports and games. They tended to be more likely to be boys, so they spent a lot of time in sports, physical exercise, but also a lot of time on the computer, including using kind of a computer or video games. And then there was the group who were very thinly spread across a range of activities, the kind of hurried child, or as we termed them, busy lives.
And you found that the busy life children, they were more likely to live in urban areas, and immigrant children were more likely to be represented in that group.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't fully account for some of the immigration variation, but definitely there was an urban-rural split when it came to what children are doing outside school. And that's, we would think, a lot to do with the kinds of facilities that are available. You know, in an urban area, there are going to be more options for structured activities after school. And that certainly was reflected in the greater take-up of a range of activities.
You also found, for example, that children in Gaelscoileanna are more likely to be in the cultural activities group.
We think it's to do with the fact that attending a Gaelscoileanna has a very specific ethos, and that is linked not only to the Irish language, but to broader kind of sort of Irish heritage, sports, GAA sports, and so on. So this group were the least likely to kind of fall into the unstructured category. So they were engaged in a number of activities, and it wasn't just to do with it being an Irish language school, because the Gaelfach schools were much more like the English language schools.
What surprised you most in the study?
I think what surprised me most was the impact of computer use, because I think a lot of the discussion about it has been quite negatively couched, that it's kind of seen as, video games, computer games are bad. Now, we weren't able to look at, obviously, kind of issues around aggression or our behaviour in that way. But an interesting thing that we did find was that the use of ICT within school, especially using kind of the internet within school, was more likely to prompt an interest in using computers for a variety of purposes outside school. It did seem that kind of a varied use of computers for learning, but also for socialising and for relaxing, that can contribute to children's learning. And that is something that could definitely be kind of tapped into in the relationship between home and school.
And that was Emer Smith from the ESRI. Well, that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. Thanks to this week's guests, Steve Wheeler and Emer Smith, and to my colleague Barry Hennessy. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.